Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Pause, Purpose, Possibility. I'm Chris Johnson, grateful as ever that you are choosing to listen in. And in this case, you found your way to part three of my really delightful, illuminating conversation with Parker J. Palmer, renowned author, educator, traveling teacher, retreat leader, activist, and as you'll hear later on in this episode, a great neighbor. So, enjoy. I'll get out of the way. Again, thanks for being here. If I may turn in a different direction along the way, I have heard you speak of and you've written about our shadow sides in connection with or under the umbrella of the importance of being whole people. Not perfect, but whole. And I grew up in a context anyway where one of the shadow sides or shadow emotions, shadow ways of being in the world involved anger, getting angry. I won't, tell stories out of turn or anything, but I want to say that on one occasion in particular is occurring to me at a retreat we were at together. I think I saw you get angry about something that mattered, and you turned red in the face and you got a little table pounding and so on and so on. And so my question is something along the lines of, I shared with you beforehand, before we talked, that back when I did my dissertation work in a former life, right, on the relationship between forgiveness and justice, I came across an article written by an ethicist named Beverly Harrison, the title of which has continued to just enthrall me and intrigue me for decades now. The title was "The Power of Anger in the Work of Love." So, Parker, what can you tell us about your own experience of or relationship with anger? How do people know when Parker is angry? What do you get angry about? And pile on the questions here. What is the power of anger in the work of love? As a person who I also know you to be committed to nonviolence in the world, right? I don't know if that is another paradox, anger and nonviolence, but make of it what you will. What occurs to you? What's bubbling to heart and mind around the power of anger in the work of love? In these times in which we live.
Yeah, exactly. My mind quickly went there, Chris. Thinking like, when was the last time I read the news? That would be when I was recently. Yeah. But to look back farther for a moment in my life, I grew up in a home where anger was uncouth.
Yes, right.
My dad was a wonderful, wonderful man. He was a Chicago businessman. He was a disciple of Norman Vincent Peale, The Power of Positive Thinking. Mm-hmm. For him, this is a direct quote, "Every day is Thanksgiving." Mm-hmm. And, you know, as one might predict, when I was in my 20s or late teens, let alone my 20s, and it turned out that every day wasn't Thanksgiving for me, I began feeling like a failure as a man, you know, because I wasn't living into my dad's archetype. It was only in, I did what I needed to do, I think, to come past that, get out of that stage for myself, but it was only in my dad's later years, that I learned more about what he was carrying that must have made him angry. Trails in the business world that, you know, helped bring to ground the business that he loved so much and had invested himself so heavily in. He must have been angry about these things, but he had this override mechanism that I'm glad I didn't adopt. And so I embarked on a journey to ask myself the very question you're asking: what's the role of anger? Is there a positive role for for anger in life? And I think the answer is absolutely yes. And I think anyone who says I'm just never angry is, I would guess that they're kidding themselves, and that they're maybe straining, as I once did, to live into a sort of anger-free norm of life, which I think is stressful and unrealistic and ultimately not creative. I think anger is an energy. And the question about any form of energy is, to what ends are you going to harness your anger? And like any form of energy, you can ride your anger toward bad ends, toward violent ends, or you can ride your anger toward creative ends, worthy ends. It can be a tricky balance, especially when there are things at work in the world that keep pushing the same anger button time and time and time and time again. I think a lot of us in the U.S. right now are wondering, how long will we have to wait until some of the criminal elements in our society that have been trying to bring down our democracy and basically destroy the ground rules by which we are asked to play in a society governed by laws, not men, how long do we have to wait before they are brought to justice? It happens little by little, bit by bit, but it can make a person crazy to see that not only are some people rich and powerful enough to keep getting away with crimes against humanity, put that in quotes because I know it doesn't live up, not all of it lives up to international legal standards that are, would be described by that phrase, but crimes against humanity that cause suffering and that degrade our common life. And why in the name of God do perhaps a third of Americans applaud these people and their behaviors? And why, again, in the name of God, is there a whole wing of the Christian church that seems devoted to running cover for this kind of malfeasance, malpractice, even criminality, flying in the face, this wing of the Christian church, flying in the face of some of its own self-evident norms and standards. So there's stuff to get angry about, and what I need to do with my anger is to keep reminding myself that I need to use this to fuel the tank of my own political involvement and engagement, and that my own political involvement and engagement is governed by standards of nonviolence, by standards of decency, by standards of love, truth, and justice. And as long as I can put that formula together, and as long as I can keep finding those creative outlets for the energy of anger, then I have good reason to believe that the anger will not destroy me. Because that's the other possibility with anger, is that it just leaves us in ruins as we fail to find creative outlets for it. Sometimes I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm not as well versed in the Bible as a lot of people are, But I do enjoy reading some of the Psalms where the psalmist is urging the Lord to smash the teeth of his enemies and thinking, well, you know, if they can talk that way here, I guess I can engage in some of my own private soliloquies around similar topics and understand that even in the context of prayer, expressions of anger can be honest and stand a chance of being transformed into something nonviolent and something life-giving. I think the litmus test is always what brings life in this situation? What is life-giving as opposed to death-dealing? And there's no reason in the world that anger has to be death-dealing, none at all. And I'll just say one more thing that's pretty obvious, I think, but maybe worth saying is that what we get angry about is often points towards what it is we most love and what it is we refuse to stand silent while it's assaulted or demeaned or deprived of life. I don't know what it was at that particular retreat that you referenced that made me a little red in the face and table pounding, but I certainly know that there have been moments in the history of the Center for Courage and Renewal when I got that way in not only retreat settings, but administrative settings as well. Because I love this work and I love the people who do it. And when something happens that threatens its integrity, I go there.
And you do so, yes, with your own deep integrity, which keeps it from becoming death dealing.
Well, I try. That's certainly my goal. And I think in answer to your question, how might one know when I'm angry? I think the simple answer is I'll let you know. You know, I'll tell you. One little piece of my history, Chris, might be worth mentioning here. When I was about 30 years old, I realized that I did not function well inside of hierarchies. And, you know, getting conflicted with whoever was in power in that hierarchy was kind of my hobby. I never wanted to be the ED or the president, even though I had offers along those lines. But I was glad to be in second or third place where I could work away at my hobby of getting conflicted with whoever was in the catbird seat. And it came to me about age 30 or early 30s that I could spend the rest of my life wasting my time and energy that way, because I did seem to have, I don't know if it was a full obsession, but it was certainly a gravitational tug in the direction of getting conflicted with power. And I made a conscious decision to try to find my way toward an independent career where I wouldn't have a boss and therefore wouldn't have any way of feeding my hobby or my pathology, one might, but instead would just be responsible for the whole kielbasa myself. And I've always been grateful that, you know, that I had the instinct to do that and that it actually worked out, because for about 40 years, I have worked independently without being on any one institution's payroll. And you know, that includes the fact that I haven't been on the payroll of the Center for Courage and Renewal. I wanted to keep my day job as a writer and traveling teacher, et cetera, et cetera. And simply wanted to support the work of the center in any way I could. So I've never been on the payroll on the board or on the staff by design. I didn't want to pose the founder problem that so often comes. The guy who started something gets old and tired and says, "I'm going to give it away to the younger generation," and then spends the next 5 years trying to get it back because he doesn't like the way it's going. So I just feel grateful for whatever form of discernment it was that led me to that very fundamental vocational decision that I wanted to work in an open space where the only person to get angry at was myself.
What are you and Sharon like as neighbors there in Madison, Wisconsin?
Well, for the last few years, we've been pretty quiet, as you said. Maybe before we started the conversation here, Chris, because both of us have some immunological issues, we tucked away from early 2020 onward through the worst of the pandemic, and only in recent months or last year, I guess, have started getting back out into the world a bit more. So I think we're reasonably helpful neighbors. We're reasonably hi, how you doing, neighbors? We
Okay, good.
have a one interesting maybe insight into us is that both of us really like to keep the house orderly. I like to keep my office orderly. I have a psychiatrist friend who says I really have a problem with being orderly. So, you know, he would when he comes over for a cup of coffee and I'm going out to the kitchen to fetch it for him, he'll move a book that I had carefully positioned on the coffee table. And when I come back in, I'll give him coffee, and then I'll relocate the book where automatically, you know, where it should be, not knowing that he moved. And he'll look at me and say, "You know, you really need to be committed, Parker." And there are days when I can't disagree. So anyway, and Sharon is big on keeping a nice garden and a nice lawn. Well, right behind our house about 10 years ago, in moves a younger couple with a bunch of kids who they don't adhere to the same standard regarding, I don't know what the inside looks like, but the lawn, not at all. Just, you know, it's like every kid's toy, outdoor toy, indoor
Oh,
toy,
sure.
possible, and lawnmower and so forth, has, you know, they find it's the stuff under the snow when spring comes, and their lawn is pretty much a mess. But here's the thing. For a while that disturbed us, and then we realized this couple is included among their children is a young teenager with a pretty serious disability, and to help and we've watched them interact with that child in the most beautiful, loving, life-giving way, along with all their other kids, and to help their income along, she runs a child care center, which in the good weather, a lot of it is happening in their backyard, and she's wonderful with these young children, the 4, 5, 6, 7 year olds. And suddenly the mess on the lawn just disappeared for us. It's like, who cares, given who these people are as human beings and the caring they're doing for these children? So that changed everything, and actually created a sense of relationship that we're very grateful for. So maybe that's one answer to who we are as neighbors.
Instead of a mess on the lawn, it became an ecosystem in which life can thrive.
Exactly. My kids enjoy every piece of that equipment, and I hope nobody cuts their finger on the upside down lawnmower.
Well, you have been incredibly generous and present as always, Parker. As I turn our corner toward winding down, if you have stamina for one or two more questions,
Sure.
the first of which would be that, as you know, the title of this still newish podcast is Pause, Purpose, Possibility. Just in parentheses here, I'll acknowledge that back when I and my young adult milkweed group colleagues were cooking this up, that was emerging as a possible title, and I tossed into the room, how about if we call it Pause, Purpose, Possibility, colon, three P's in a podcast?
Oh.
And they,
They didn't like that. Well,
they
what's
helped me to see beyond.
wrong with these young people?
At any rate, for now, we're going with Pause, Purpose, Possibility. What occurs to you in your own life and world these days around any or all of those? How do you experience pause? What does purpose mean to you? What possibility do you sense yourself living into? Just what do you make of any of the words that make up the title of the podcast?
Well, at age 85, that's kind of baseline for me right now. Pausing needs to happen several times a day, and I'm grateful that I live a life where that's possible. And pausing might mean doing something that I didn't have the sense to do 10 years ago, which is just walking away from my writing for a while, look out the window for 20 minutes, and then come back, and lo and behold, a particular knot gets untied pretty quickly in the writing that I've been struggling with. Or it might mean a nap, in the afternoon. I'm grateful to live a life where I can take naps, which I thoroughly enjoy. And in some ways, it should be said I'm heading towards the big pause, right? Or who knows? Whether we wake up from that nap and or not, and if we do, what we see or what we know. Purpose is always a question. And for me, it's always an emergent question. I think purpose has in part to do with this thing, this daemon side of me that keeps calling me to a particular kind of work, but it also has to do with how that energy intersects opportunities in the world or in those parts of the world which are now within my reach. And those are different parts of the world than used to be. And it's interesting to kind of wonder about that intersection of purpose between my gifts and my opportunities to serve, which keep changing. I mean, in some ways, my gifts I think remain pretty constant, although I think there is some deepening in maybe my ability to hold complex, nuanced thoughts, and then the opportunities keep changing to share those gifts in ways that might be useful to others. The possibility is something that it's a word that for me is kind of like hope. I mean, when people say, "Do you have hope?" I say, "Well, what would I do without it?" And all I can imagine is maybe sitting on a stool in the corner, facing the corner and just feeling miserable about everything. That's not a fit way for a grown-up to live, so I'm not going to live that way. So hope and possibility are are for me always alive, and I'm looking around for the next iteration of how the hope and possibility might manifest itself in my life.
And you said earlier, not to quote yourself back to you, but you said earlier about that the work is not done. And you still have plenty of daemon, plenty of urgency, of passion, of gifts to offer.
Yeah, and the work really isn't done. I mean, one of the blessings of being a writer, Chris, is that you know, your work goes out into the world to places that you can't imagine. You never imagined.
Yeah, right.
You did not write with this particular intention. And suddenly there it is. And a bunch of that has been happening to me lately. I'll give you two examples.
Yeah.
The Courage to Teach, my book called The Courage to Teach, was translated into Chinese a few years ago. And the Chinese edition of that book has now sold 350,000 copies. And with the foundation the book provides, across China, there's a Courage to Teach program that's
wow.
similar to, and has been up and running for 5 years, similar to that which is offered in this country by the Center for Courage and Renewal. So the other day I was on Zoom for a couple of hours with a group of teachers in China for whom it was 1 a.m. in the morning, recording a conversation that will by now have been, or maybe in June, will be included in a national virtual and in-person, what do you, hybrid,
yeah.
Courage to Teach gathering for teachers across China. That's astonishing to me, but very real. And then equally astonishing is that about 8 or 9 months ago, I got an email from a dissident group of teachers in Iran, who informed me that they had gone ahead and translated The Courage to Teach into Farsi or Persian, and were giving it major publicity in one of their professional newspaper/journals.
Yeah.
I was able to get a bunch of that translated and see, yeah, this is the real McCoy. And would I please write a foreword to this edition, which, by the way, they didn't ask, they explained this to me. We didn't ask for permission because Iran does not honor international copyright laws. And for me, that was great. I've always wished that people in places where they couldn't afford the copyright could just have the material. You know, do you write? So that's happening in Iran, and I wrote that forward, in which I skated right on the edge, you know, about educators as truth tellers.
Yes, wow.
Educators as those who help prepare a new generation to hold our leaders accountable. Educators as those who transmit the best of the common culture and critique the rest. And now I've been invited to give a Zoom lecture. This is an email I have to answer tomorrow. Give a Zoom lecture to a big gathering of professors in Tehran about some of these topics. So it's just, you know, for, as I said, one of the gifts of writing is you don't know where these bottles that you toss into the ocean with messages in them are going to wash up and be read and received. And it's a lot of fun to find out.
Thank you for sharing those. Okay, last question / invitation. I have been trying to end each of the episodes of the podcast so far with a gift to our listeners of a big question or two and a practice, things to take with them to continue to reflect on, incorporate into their lives what they may have heard throughout the episode. So I wonder if you have any suggestions or things to gift to our listeners today in the spirit of a question or two or three and or a practice that they can take with them.
Well, if I may, and tell me if I may not.
Oh, please.
If
Think
I
check.
May, but I would like to answer that question the way politicians answer questions. I'd like to deflect.
Okay.
And suggest that as a gift, I'd like to read a poem that I wrote.
Oh, yes.
And I think maybe in some ways the poem, rightly understood, will actually contain questions that, and maybe in some ways revisit parts of our conversation, which I'm so grateful for, Chris. So I so value.
Isn't I?
The nuance of your questions. So if you'll give me just a moment, I'm going to pull this poem up from
sure.
My...
And while you're doing that, I'll, and I hope I'm not going to steal your thunder or anything here, but I had occasion earlier today in talking with some of our Courage and Renewal colleagues, we had occasion to remember a poem that we've encountered of yours. We couldn't remember the details, but we think it was called something like Snow. And it goes something like, snow, snow, snow. It's really cold. And so on and so on. So if that's the poem that you're hoping to share with us now.
I shouldn't do it.
No, please. Because people will want to hear the real version beyond the very badly paraphrased version that I just shared. And if you have a different one in mind, that's completely fine and welcome
yeah, actually,
as well.
I have a different one in mind, but in defense of my snow poem, I do to quote it properly.
Yes, okay.
The snow poem goes like this.
All right. Oh, good.
I release it whenever the first snow arrives in Madison. So it goes like this. It's quite profound, so you have to really hang in with it. Snow, 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 snow. Why does it always come and go? It hardly makes a sound, although sometimes I can hear it if I listen real good.
Yes, that's the one. That's the one.
That's it. That's, yes, that's a, I always say when I post it on my Facebook author page, I always say, every year I receive thousands of requests about this poem, but I publish it anyway.
And for folks who haven't encountered it before, they can say that they heard it here.
Heard it here first. And yeah, I'm sorry you hadn't heard it before because it will enrich your life. So this is a poem that came to me several years ago when I was waking up one morning and there was this line in my head that would not go away. And the line was, everything falls away. Everything falls away. And for a couple of weeks, I just, as happens with poems sometimes, I just kept tracking that line, sort of asking it, where do you want to go? And what is this all about? And this poem is what emerged. And it's a poem that I keep returning to because I think, for me at least, there's a lot in it. And I think you'll find that a couple of major themes of this conversation are in it as well. So it begins with a little epigraph, a little two-line epigraph, which is a quote from a poem by William Stafford. And I'm, so let me read the title and then the epigraph and then my poem itself. Everything falls away. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. William Stafford. Sooner or later, everything falls away. You, the work you've done, your successes, large and small, your failures, too. Those moments when you were light alongside the times you became one with the night. The friends, the people you loved who loved you, those who might have wished you ill. None of this is forever. All of it is soon to go, or going, or long gone. Everything falls away except the thread you followed unknowing all along, the thread that strings together all you've been and done, the thread you didn't know you were tracking until toward the end, you see that the thread is what stays as everything else falls away. Follow that thread as far as you can, and you'll find that it does not end, but weaves into the unimaginable vastness of life. Your life never was the solo turn it seemed to be. It was always part of the great weave of nature and humanity, an immensity we come to know only as we follow our own small threads to the place where they merge with the boundless whole. Each of our threads runs its course, then joins in life together. This magnificent tapestry, this masterpiece in which we live forever.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you for that. Thank you for, again, the generosity and depth of our time together today. Thank you for being who you've been in my life.
Back at you.
Thank you. Thank you. I will be in touch, and you feel free to do the same.
I'll do it. I treasure this opportunity. Thank you so much. And if you ever want to do it again, give me a chance to catch my breath and we'll do it again.